For the week of October 11th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 24, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, we're going to have a couple of special guests on today's episode. We're going to have Jeff Boucher from the Los Angeles Times, and he's going to be here to talk about his blog, Hero Blog, or no, Hero Complex is the name of his blog, which is on the LA Times website. We're also going to have Ann Thompson from Thompson on Hollywood, which can now be found on IndieWire, and a journalist that I've known for some time, James Rocky. He's a freelance entertainment journalist, and his writing can be found on MSN and on the Redbox website and just about everywhere. He writes for a lot of people. Well, before we begin our rundown of the week's top entertainment news stories, as we do every week, why don't we start off with box office? And Michael, why don't you tell us who won, who didn't win, which movies tanked, which movies were surprise hits? I'm running out of cliches.
Et cetera.
So, yeah.
All right. So, this week you want to start from the bottom to the top, right? Just like the French?
Sure, just like the French. Start okay. At the bottom. Work our way up.
I don't
up.
Know what that means, but okay.
Let's insult a few other nationalities while we continue the podcast. What do you think?
I'm going to start at number 11, where Matt Damon...
I just like the idea of starting at the bottom.
I'm going to start at number 11 instead of 10, where The Informant grossed another $2 million, is now at about $30 million, which is not bad for a film that I think cost about $16 million to make. At 10 is Fame, which is fading fast and is at about $20 million. Number 9 is Capitalism, A Love Story, which dropped about 40%. It made $2.7 million, which is more than most documentaries make in their entire history, and it is now at $9 million. So it's definitely low on the end for Michael Moore, but, you know, still great for almost any other documentary. And number 8 is Drew Barrymore's film Whip It, which made $2.8 million and is at about $8.7 million. It's a very low-budget film, probably not an embarrassment and not a bad first film. At number 7 is The Invention of Lying, which made $3.3 million. That's the Ricky Gervais film, the genius behind The Office and Extras, who can't seem to translate into feature films. At number 6 is the Bruce Willis sci-fi flick Surrogates, which has now grossed a total of $32 million and is fading fast. And number 5 is the reissue of Toy Story and Toy Story 2 double feature in 3D, which is what I saw this weekend. That made another $7.7 million, so that's another $22 million total. Number 4 is the big box office news of the week, Paranormal Activity, a smaller-than-small indie film, which grossed an amazing $7 million on about 150 screens, and its total is now $9 million. It's definitely
totally want to see that.
I know. Number 3 is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which made $12 million. That's at $95 million. It's about to break through $100 million. Number 2 is Zombieland, the funnest movie from last week. It made another $15 million. It's at $47 million. And the number 1 movie of the week, a gigantic $35 million for Couples Retreat, the romantic comedy that nobody found romantic or comedic.
Really?
I think it sounds funny.
The reviews were blisteringly bad. I don't know what its Rotten Tomatoes score is, but the reviews were across the board bad. I couldn't bring myself to see it. It just looked so rote that I just couldn't bear it.
Well, I know we're going to be talking about Couples Retreat later when we have Ann Thompson and James Rocky on, because Ann, in her piece, the piece was on bloggers and whether they break the journalistic rules. She talks about James Rocky attending the press junket for that film, which was held conveniently in Bora Bora.
And I have to say, in the trailers, Bora Bora looks stunningly beautiful.
It really does look amazing.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they needed to shoot there. Couldn't they have shot Malibu?
Because it looks like Bora Bora. No, Bora Bora looks amazing. You know, they could have done digital effects maybe, but I mean, the waters looks like sapphire. It looks amazing. did you see any movies this weekend?
Well, before we get off of Couples
no,
Retreat.
No, I just need to say, did I do anything this weekend? Karen got out of town this weekend.
Oh, all right.
You were so close.
Oh.
You were so close to being able to say, and from insert place here.
I know. And from Victoria on Vancouver Island.
Well, so no movies for you. What did you want to talk about, Sperling?
Well, I was just really shocked that Couples Retreat made so much money because, like you, I saw all the reviews and it was panned. It received mixed reviews at best. And I have to say that Vince Vaughn and some of the other actors and actresses from that film have been doing the talk show circuit and plugging the film.
Yeah.
And did you see Vince Vaughn on Letterman, by the way?
Yes.
Was he drunk?
No, he wasn't drunk. He didn't seem drunk to me.
Wait, what happened?
He just was, like, rambling a mile a minute.
Oh, he's very funny. I think he's a great guest. Did you see him when he substituted for Letterman, when Letterman was out for a heart surgery?
I did not see that.
Letterman had a series of guests, you know, guest host the show for him, which is probably the most unnerving thing any talk show host can do because they're all so paranoid and, you know, competitive. The last thing they want is someone to come on and do well. But he was out. He'd had heart surgery, emergency surgery, and they had guest hosts, you know, a different one every day for like a week or 2 weeks or something like that. And Vince Vaughn did it one night, and it was unbelievable. It was like he was born to be a talk show host. He was so smooth and confident. He was so great. He was bantering with Paul. I'll be stunned if he wasn't offered a talk show because he was that good and everybody raved and it was unbelievable. He took to it like a duck to water, and he's been a favorite Letterman guest before that, but really ever since as well, because I think Letterman complimented him a lot and really enjoyed it. And so he's always fun when he's on the show.
And he was very funny this past week when he was there to promote.
Yes.
He was really funny just all over the place, though, rambling, and you just didn't know where he was going to go next. Neither did David Letterman. If you actually watched him, it looked like he had no clue where it was headed.
Exactly.
And of course, Letterman's ratings are way up thanks to his little controversy over having had sexual relationships with some of his staff.
But I hear that his funny is way down.
That's not true, actually. He did a bit where he started talking about different people, different celebrity and politician sex scandals, and he kind of had to stop himself because every time he started, he realized, oh, yeah, I really can't talk about that.
I'm troubled by the fact that people are finding sex scandals really hysterical, but that we talked about last week.
Yes, indeed.
Well, there's a difference between a sex scandal and sexual harassment of an employee. And if it does come out that, you know, there were six or seven employees who all felt obliged to sleep with Dave, we'll all take a dimmer view of him. But I don't think he had a 1 or 2 day bump in the ratings that was beyond what he's been doing. But I think his ratings have been up because he's competing against Conan. He's been, you know, leading ever since Conan took over and Jay Leno left.
Right. Although Conan is still leading in the 18 to 49 year old market, which everybody seems to believe is so valuable.
That's right. Just barely. Conan has like a 1.0 in the 18 to 34 market, and Letterman has a 0.9 in that demo. It's clear Letterman is the ratings winner. Leno shed a bunch of old people and appeals to a much younger demo. And so it's maybe not a complete disaster for them, but I'm sure they'd wish he hadn't lost, you know, 2 million, 3 million viewers. So, you know, they can paint it in as positive a way they want, but, you know, there is good news to be said, but it's pretty slim.
Well, you asked me something about, or you asked both of us something about 5, 10, 15 minutes ago, whenever you asked what movie I saw this week. I took the kids to see Toy Story and Toy Story 2 in 3D. Which they were able to sit through the first one because they'd seen it before. I showed it to them like maybe a week ago. And by the second one, they weren't really all that interested. But I have to say, the big drawback was 3D. They could have cared less that the movie was in 3D. And the glasses do not fit toddlers. They don't fit a 4-year-old. They don't fit a 3.5-year-old. And so their glasses were falling off of them. I had to tie them onto their heads with my shoelaces.
Really?
Yes, it was really pretty pretty horrible.
Well,
okay,
I
think this only proves my point, and I think my thought might have been yours too. They're like, nobody cares about 3D.
Yeah, I was delighted to see the movies in the theater again. I could have cared less if they were in 3D. It was fine. It was a modest little tweaking of the movie. It works because they were in computer animated, so it was very natural. It didn't feel like they tried to force stuff, but it was not a selling point for me at all. I would have gladly gone to see them this weekend. The 3D was negligible. Not, you know, it was utterly unimportant. I don't think anybody ever goes to see a movie because it's in 3D. I know it seems crazy because you look at the – if it's available in 3D, yes, you'll choose that over 2D because that's the way the movie was meant to be seen. Just like if it's in color, I won't go see it in black and white. But I didn't go, oh, my God, I have to see Toy Story in 3D. I want to see Woody's, you know, arms stretch out into the middle of the auditorium. But the best part for the movie for me was the trailer for Toy Story 3. What did you think of that?
I think it looks pretty good.
I thought it looked great. I was so worried about them doing another sequel because I think Toy Story 2 is one of the great sequels, and Toy Story 3 looked great. Basically, they get Andy, the boy, goes to college, and the toys get donated to a nursery school, which is like a nightmare existence for a doll or a toy, because you've got all these little toddlers running around, throwing them against the wall, chewing on them, fighting over them.
Oh.
So, and Buzz Lightyear gets reset. He defaults, and they have to restart him, and they restart him by pressing a button in the back, and he starts speaking Spanish. So I think for like half the film, Buzz Lightyear talks in Spanish. It looked really, really funny.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that, I have to say, looked amazing. And another movie that looks kind of interesting and is not on this week's box office, because it will be coming out, I believe, at the end of October or sometime in November, Mr. Fox, which is Wes Anderson's next movie. It's a stop-motion animated film. And Chris Lee in the Los Angeles Times wrote a very interesting piece on the film and how it was made, and it was kind of negative towards the filmmaker, Wes Anderson.
Well, it should be. It sounds completely bizarre. Wes Anderson says basically, yeah, I made the film by, you know, email. He set up the idea. He gave his ideas to the animators, told them what he wanted to do, and then he took off for Paris.
And he stayed in Paris, in his apartment in Paris. Not that he had anything to do in Paris. But and he wasn't working on a project there. It's just that he didn't want to be locked up in England for 2 years while working on the project. Although Chris Lee, he says, to be clear, Wes Anderson did not set out to direct his new movie via email, even if that's precisely how the writer-director's stop-motion animation version of Roald Dahl's beloved children's book, Fantastic Mr. Fox, a jaunty visual joyride that features voice characterizations by George Clooney, Meryl Streep, and Jason Schwartzman, ultimately came to be. Anderson never intended to become an in-box auteur. That choice was made all but inevitable, however, by the Oscar nominee's unorthodox decision to hole up in Paris for most of the shoot's one-year duration, while principal photography commenced across the English Channel at 3 Mill Studios for 2 years.
See, that's when you take a producing credit like Tim Burton did on Henry Selick's Nightmare Before Christmas. If you don't want to direct the film and be there to oversee it, take a producing credit, even if you came up with the idea, and step aside and let somebody else who actually directed it get the credit for it. It's ridiculous.
Well, the film's director of animation, Mark Gustafson, in the article was quoted as saying, honestly, yeah, he made our lives miserable. He gave a little chuckle, and then he went on to say, I probably shouldn't say that. And the film's director of photography, Tristan Oliver, or Tristan Oliver, depending on whether he's French or not. Yeah. He says, I think he's a little sociopathic. I think he's a little OCD. Contact with people disturbs him. This way, he can spend an entire day locked inside an empty room with a computer. He's a bit like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain.
Okay, sure.
Well, and Anderson thinks that he went against the grain, and he said, I don't want to make this film the way animation is made today. I don't want green screen. I don't want to use computer-generated effects. I want to make it the old-fashioned way. So Chris Lee says he ignored the majority viewpoint in pursuit of something specific, a cool-looking, detail-saturated, retro-leaning stop-motion movie, even if that meant bucking conventional animation wisdom by avoiding the modern technology that pervades the genre these days. And
no, that's awesome. He had fun ideas, interesting ideas. He wanted a retro feel. That's great. But the really old-fashioned way of making a movie is to actually be on the set and be involved when you're actually making the movie, not to be off in some other country and going, hey, how's everything going? Cool. Talk to you later. He came up with ideas. That's what a screenwriter or a producer does. A director needs to be involved day to day. Sorry. I don't care if it's boring or not. That's not directing. He had great ideas. I like everything he says in the article about how he wants real fur and he wants this and he wants clouds to be cotton balls. Not everything had to be shot in camera, meaning no items inserted digitally. He wanted everything to be on the actual physical set and shot with a camera. So if you had a house in the background or a stormy sky, you had to create a stormy sky so you could shoot it. You couldn't just put it in digitally later. Awesome. Wonderful. But, you know, you got to be involved. You have to show up occasionally in order to call yourself a director.
Oh, he's just so twee.
Oh, my God.
As we've talked about on a previous episode. Well, Chris Lee's article appeared in the Los Angeles Times, and we have another journalist from the Los Angeles Times that we are meant to be speaking with right now. We should dial him up and get him on the phone, and I'm doing so as we speak. Okay. Joining us now, we have Jeff Boucher from the Los Angeles Times. Growing up, Jeff always wanted to be a mild-mannered reporter working for a major metropolitan newspaper. Or maybe a Wookiee. He came to the Los Angeles Times in 1991, and after years covering crime and local politics, he switched to the Hollywood beat covering film and music. Now he's the paper's go-to geek. Welcome, Jeff.
The go-to geek says thank you for the nice welcome.
That was actually your bio on the Los Angeles Times.
That's a fantastic bio.
It won't be within an hour, but I appreciate that.
Well, full disclosure, Jeff and I have known each other since college. We both worked in our college newspaper, the Independent Florida Alligator, at the University of Florida in Gainesville, and that's how we met. And it was very exciting to see Jeff's name suddenly pop up one day in the middle of the LA Times entertainment section writing about George Lucas and Indiana Jones and Star Wars, and he's going to Skywalker Ranch, and it was very fun. So he's been covering the hero fanboy fantasy sci-fi beat for quite a while now.
Thanks very much, Michael. It's always good to talk to you, and those were great days in Gainesville, and hopefully there's no permanent record of them anywhere.
Hang on, let me check YouTube.
So your blog at you're a reporter for the LA Times. You write print articles for them, which also appear online. But you also launched a blog called Hero Complex for Your Inner Fanboy. Was it hard to get them? I mean, they must be encouraging reporters to launch blogs and do things all the time. Was it hard to get them to commit to this idea, or was it easy, or do they, you know, and do they see it as like part of your job or some extra thing that you do while you do all your other work?
No, it's a good question. Well, and you know, there's many different points of view, and the viewpoints changed as the months went along. But early on, what it was is that my editors were only worried that it would undercut my output for the print edition. You know, I was covering rock and roll and hip-hop and music, so this was other. You know, it wasn't a blog that would naturally fill in blanks or stem out of my print work. But then the blog did very, very well, and we started off as covering Comic-Con, and then it became a standing feature, and there was a lot of excitement about it because it has a younger readership than a lot of the traditional readers of our, say, coverage of politics and local issues. So they thought it was bringing new people to the website, and now they moved me over to covering film, so a lot of what I do on the blog goes hand-in-hand with what I do for print, and then a lot of the stuff that goes in the blog, a significant portion of it actually does eventually appear in print as sort of the best of the blog.
Mm-hmm. When you say it's attracting readers, do you get a hit for how many unique visitors you have a month, or how do they track the sort of readership your blog is getting?
You know, they do that. I see the hit traffic. I mean, we had 1.2 million hits in July, which was the peak for just the, you know, that's just the blog, and it's not a full, you know, news website or anything. It's really just a blog. It's me putting up three or four posts a day, so that's quite a lot. And we just won an award, a national award for a commentary and blogging for major journalism websites, which was very, very nice. And again, makes me worry about the priorities of the world.
Well, and actually, that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you, because on October 3rd, you received the award for best online commentary among large websites from the Online News Association.
And what I love is that the LA Times ran a story, very happy, very proud of this accomplishment, and they ran a story that appears online, Hero Complex, the LA Times blog devoted to Cape Crusaders, zombies, wizards, blah, 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 what an award, and they did not link to the blog. So newspapers still have this mentality. They forgot to put in a link.
You know, again, along with my bio, that will be repaired within the hour.
Make sure you put award-winning journalist when you fix your bio. So it's do you think there's a point where they will understand that the blog is a primary thing? Do you think there'll be that sort of sea change? They're now see maybe as sort of equal to what you do, or just as important, perhaps?
You know, I think it varies by the person you're talking to, you know, literally in the newsroom. And I think that there's some people in the newsroom that have no idea I even do it, you know, but they know the stories I write for the front page of the paper. You know, I think I've had a dozen A1 stories this year in the LA Times, and they know about that. And then there's other people that I talk to that have never seen the print edition, and they only know me for the blog. And I can't tell you where how it's weighted right now. I do know that my bosses at the paper are thrilled with it now, and they see it as evidence that I'm working way too hard. They actually, a rare thing, they actually tell me not to work as much,
Whoa, that's amazing.
Yeah, I know. I think that they're just lying. But they there's a sense that the thing has reached a tipping point where it's its own thing now. So they certainly do appreciate it and understand it, but not universally. There's people in the newsroom that would never look at it or may not even know it's there. And that story without the link, you know, that was written on a Sunday night by a fill-in reporter. So I don't think anybody expected me to win, so we didn't have it ready. So that's probably why I didn't have a link.
Nice.
Well, now you say you get 1.2 million hits per month. Is that hits or unique visitors? Because if it's unique visitors, then...
It's hits.
Well, there's a difference.
No, there is a big difference, and that's the hits. I don't know the unique visitors off the top of my head. I saw that... because I get a standard report once a week, and it's hits, not unique visitors, but I could figure that out for you guys, but I don't know it off the top of my head.
Well, it seems to me then that this could be a standalone blog that could make money, meaning that the LA Times is actually doing pretty well financially because of this.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we have a number of blogs that are doing extremely well, and my blog is not the top blog by any means. I'm in the top 5 to 7. Last month, I was number 11 at the paper. We have 40 blogs, and they're generating tons and tons of hits. And the paper's doing extremely well as far as web traffic. We're the fastest growing newspaper in the world online.
What are the top blogs?
We have one called Dish Rag, which is gossip and extremely shrill and annoying.
It is shrill and annoying.
Is not being recorded, right? No,
no.
I'm just joking. we have Dish Rag, which is a gossip based. It's a gossip blog. It does very well. Our top of the ticket political blog by Andrew Malcolm became a fixture during the last election, and sometimes triples my traffic. We have a blog called LA Now, which is a repository for all our breaking news in Southern California, and you know, it routinely spikes up, especially if there's a month where we have forest fires or earthquakes or some other disaster like Manny Ramirez.
well, and you obviously are low scoring August and September because that's a very slow time for superhero stuff, I imagine. Once Comic-Con happened, things slowed down a little bit until we hit Thanksgiving and Christmas. You'll pick up a lot again when we get up there.
That's right. And also, you know, I was on vacation and such. So, there's always something now. You know, it used to be Comic-Con, but now, you know, you look and we saw, you know, spikes of traffic, obviously, for Potter, the most recent Harry Potter film. But then, you know, things like District 9, we got a lot of traffic because people were curious about it. And, you know, what is this thing? And, you know, and then when we do series like this franchise, the four film franchise, you know, at a crossroads, we saw a real spike in traffic. Anything that goes over a period of days and has people coming back, we get a lot more traffic. I did a 3-part interview with Christopher Nolan, who doesn't do a lot of interviews. You know, that one was peaked at like 116,000 hits on just day 3, I think.
Wow. That's awesome. So, well, let's talk about this.
No, I have a question. What is it about heroes that you find so appealing? I mean, did you always, like, want to be Darth Vader or something? I mean, or not?
It was Chewbacca, actually. When I was a kid, I had, not to get into too much psychoanalytical stuff, but I had a very insular life. I wasn't raised in a neighborhood where there was a lot of kids. I was a very heavy kid, so I read a lot of comics. I loved Star Wars. I kind of fell into going to comic book shops and stuff. I think I just loved the sort of the excitement of the a visually told story, and I think there's a lot of people that grew up enjoying that stuff, and now we see Hollywood with the CGI effects and also a generation of filmmakers like Sam Raimi, you know, for instance, who grew up with a Spider-Man mural above his bed, who treat the genre material with a lot more respect and they don't have their tongue in their cheek when they're doing it. So I think that that's why we're having this golden age. You have the filmmakers that want to do it, and you have the special effects to realize visions that before could only be done on a page of Marvel Comics.
But we're also kind of in the age of the remake and the sequel, which I guess started in the 80s and probably even before that. I'm sorry, Michael, go ahead.
The sequel started when Hollywood began making movies. After the first hit is when they started sequels. There was a sequel to King Kong in like 6 months after the original came out.
Okay, well, I guess this was my poor segue then into saying another reason that we wanted to talk to you, Jeff, is because of the series you did on films that are entering their fourth sequel, including The Lord of the Rings, which is going to be doing The Hobbit, Spider-Man, the X-Men franchise, and Pirates of the Caribbean. And you have, I guess it was a four-day series.
That's correct.
And now you have a poll asking readers, which, by the way, you can still go and vote. It's asking readers to I guess, which franchise is making a mistake with a fourth film, Spider-Man, Lord of the Rings, Pirates of the Caribbean, or X-Men. It seems that X-Men and Pirates of the Caribbean have 35 and 38% of the vote, whereas Spider-Man only has 20% of the vote, and Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, only has 7%. So everybody wants to see The Hobbit.
Yeah.
And this is actually, there are thousands of votes here, so this is somewhat telling.
Yeah, we're up to about 7,800 votes right now. And we saw Pirates of the Caribbean had half the vote going into the weekend. 52% of the people were saying kill it now, basically. And that's really changed. You know, X-Men has surged up now, so it's 38%, 32 to 35% saying, you know, X-Men should go. And I think what it is I saw that on some of the Johnny Depp sites, fans said, Pirates is losing, go vote for X-Men. So we like that.
What did you, thinking about the four movies, was there anything new that came to mind or that you learned while you were thinking about them or writing about them or talking to people about them?
Oh, that's a very good question. You know, I had a sense of it. You know, my sense was that Pirates had run out of steam and that X-Men had made too many mistakes and that Spider-Man had something to prove and that Lord of the Rings Hobbit was just starting a new chapter. And those basic beliefs did not change. And in fact, they just took on more layers and filled out. But I did. There were some nuances I hadn't anticipated. You know, I have a little more hope for the X-Men than I expected. I thought after Brett Ratner's destruction of that franchise, that I just didn't really want to see it on the screen anymore. But in talking off the record to some people that are very, very closely associated with the franchise as it moves forward, I found a little glimmer of hope there that maybe it would be worth pursuing. Although I'm still on the side of skepticism.
And I learned something. I learned that in the comments section, I was corrected by people because I hadn't heard that Peter Jackson and Guillermo del Toro had given up on the idea of creating a second film out of whole cloth, bridging The Hobbit to The Fellowship of the Ring. That in fact they're going to expand The Hobbit to two films. And they will show some things that weren't necessarily depicted in the book full blown, but basically they're going to make The Hobbit and turn it into two films rather than try and create a whole new film out of just what they imagined happened between those stories. And that's true, right?
Absolutely.
That was a big change. I think that's a big reason to be more confident, because that second film was a really, really risky idea. But The Hobbit, there's plenty of stuff to do to make that two solid films.
I think so as well. And, you know, I think Guillermo del Toro is just a fascinating filmmaker. I think he's got a very interesting take on the world and on his, I think his visual sense, proven especially by Pan's Labyrinth.
I think
the guy's just a compelling guy to watch. And it'll be very interesting to see what different directions he goes in than Jackson went in. And I think that the movies will be successful. And I think, and I say that both commercially and artistically, I don't think that they're going to be on the scale of the previous three, just because I don't think they can be. I think that the original trilogy was so huge. And I think that some of the readers thought I was slagging on it, when really all I was saying is, you know, on a scale, I just don't think that a Guillermo del Toro version of The Hobbit is going to be the second or third highest grossing film of all time, which it would have to do to compete with the Jackson trilogy, at least commercially.
Well, at least as scope, it shouldn't be on the same scale, because The Hobbit is a much simpler tale.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, there's not as many characters. It's not as far-reaching. It's not quite as ambitious, at least, you know, as far as the kingdoms created. So, but I think it'll be intriguing no matter what. But, you know, I think a lot of people, if you look at the comments, they thought I was saying that it was going to suck, which I don't think I ever said. Yeah, that's okay.
And now you'll get to break into theater, covering theater, because Spider-Man is hitting Broadway.
I don't know about the Spider-Man musical. You know, it's being planned as the most expensive production in the history of Broadway, and it's a difficult time to be launching the most expensive production in the history of Broadway. And there's a lot of moving pieces, and Julie Taymor has a very particular vision, and I think some of the finance people are finding that that vision is going to cost even more than they thought. And you know, and it's also not a sure thing that that Bono and Edge, who are very good at sort of arching, inspiring rock and roll, can, you know, create the music for a successful Broadway venture. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that one.
Are you in just like heaven, being able to spend your days talking about this stuff and being paid to do it?
Yeah, and who's your favorite superhero?
It absolutely rocks. Yeah, no, I'm very excited about it. It's an awful lot of fun, and you know what's really great about it is that being at the LA Times, we get access to people that a lot of the people that are writing about the sector, that are in the sector writing about these things, can't get access to the people that we get. You know, I can get Guillermo del Toro and John Favreau on the phone and, you know, interview Robert Downey Jr. And Christopher Nolan and stuff. So it's a wonderful mix. I think if you check out the blog, you see that I have the kind of the real fan passion for it, but hopefully the standards and certainly the access of a powerful presence that is the LA Times. And so I pinch myself all the time. I got to take my kids on the set of Harry Potter. I got to take, you know, my son on the set of Iron Man 2, and then for me to go, you know, to Australia to interview a guy in a Superman suit. It's a pretty good mix of things. And my favorite superhero would have to be Batman, clearly.
Which
Why?
Batman?
Why clearly?
Which
yeah.
Batman?
Why Batman? He's rich. He's got a cool car. He's challenged to overcome everything without the benefit of being an all-powerful alien.
And who was your favorite Batman?
Well, Neil Adams' Batman from the comics would be my favorite sort of, you know, articulation of the character. And The Dark Knight by Frank Miller, Dark Knight Returns. On screen, you know, it would surprise you to know that I actually think that Val Kilmer was a pretty great Batman. I didn't think that movie was good, but I thought he was pretty great. But I have a little Christian Bale fatigue, but I'm leery of saying Christian Bale.
Well, now, later in the podcast, we are going to be talking to Ann Thompson and James Rocky, who are now bloggers. When you went to Australia to cover Superman, was that paid for by the studio or by the Los Angeles Times?
The Los Angeles Times. We never take anything from the studio.
Well, just figured I'd confirm.
Well, of course not. We're talking about this FCC ruling that in December, bloggers will have to identify when they've been handed cash or given some money to review a product or talk about something and disclose that they have these connections. And Ann Thompson said, well, why just bloggers? There are all these newspapers in middle America that take, you know, free junket trips to Pearl Harbor so they can cover the, you know, press junket of Pearl Harbor, or they go to Bora Bora to cover, you know, couples retreat. And I personally was astonished. I had no idea any real newspaper would do that. I assumed some sleazy freelance journalists would do it, but I didn't think anybody at a real paper or magazine would do it, but apparently it's fairly widespread.
You know, I don't have a good answer for how widespread it is. I don't have a perception of that. I know that most newspapers, my instinct is that they don't, because they would be just destroyed by their peers. You know, the LA Times doesn't, but I, you know, and we never have, and we are, well, I don't know if we did in the 50s, but I mean, we haven't in modern history of the paper. But I do find that some people are still surprised when I tell them that. You know, they assume that, you know, we're getting paid, or that the studio's paying the bill. And sometimes the studios will still ask, do you guys do this? And we're like, no, we never do and never did. I went to an event in Vancouver last month. I went on the set of Fringe, and I interviewed J.J. Abrams and the cast, and then went to a DVD release party after, and it was populated mostly by online journalists who had been had their plane tickets and their hotels paid for by the Warner Home Video. So I know it definitely happens, but it doesn't happen in our shop.
Even if you weren't at a newspaper, wouldn't you? You would never do that, because wouldn't you feel like you weren't a real journalist if you started taking money? You can't be a journalist and take money from them to cover them, right?
No, I agree with you. I would feel very whorish doing that. There's an interesting thing that happened at the University of Florida, in fact, when we were there, Michael, I went to a football game once, and I went up to the press box, and I remember there was a journalist there. I want to say that he was writing for maybe the Tampa Tribune, but I can't remember, so I shouldn't say what paper it was. But he's a heavyset guy, and there was a lot of food around. And I remember I was in the height of my idealistic college journalism days. I said, "Do you think it's really appropriate for you to take all this free stuff from the university?" And he asked, "Did you think I was going to change the score?" And I said, "No, but if the starting safety gets arrested on a Thursday night and the team asks you to look the other way because it's not going to end up with any charges, maybe you think about it." I said, "What about the ethics?" And I'll never forget, his mouth was overflowing with food as he said, "Ethics, schmethics, pass the potato salad."
Ethic and title.
I think it's the greatest single motto I've ever heard in my life. And I think, Michael, that maybe we should start a website called Ethics Schmethics Pass the Potato Salad and list all the Midwest newspapers that are going to Bora Bora to ask Jon Favreau how great his movie is.
Well, Jeff, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Hopefully maybe down the road for Avatar or something else, we'll cajole you again. But congratulations on all the success with the blog and continued success at the LA Times.
Thanks for the attention and the time. And Michael, it's always good talking to you. And I look forward to chatting with you guys again.
Thanks.
Okay. Take care.
Well, that was great of Jeff to take the time to talk to us. I read his Hero Complex blog all the time at the LA Times. And it's fun to see all the top directors he gets to speak to. I don't know if he's ever spoken to Mike Nichols, but we saw in the news this week that Mike Nichols is being tapped by the AFI. The American Film Institute is going to receive their Lifetime Achievement Award. It certainly makes sense. He's a great director. He's made good movies and Broadway and television and comedy albums that have all been standard bearers for 40 years now. He, of course, did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He won an Oscar for The Graduate. He did Catch 22, The Fortunes, Silkwood, Working Girl, Primary Colors, Charlie Wilson's War, Carnal Knowledge, which is a great film, Postcards from the Edge. And the year that Working Girl came out, he did a Neil Simon movie, Biloxi Blues, which I think is even better. It's a sort of a underappreciated gem starring Matthew Broderick. But I don't think anybody can doubt that Mike Nichols deserves this honor.
Plus, he's married to Diane Sawyer.
That's true.
That's right.
And he's won an Emmy for Wit.
A television movie adaptation of the off-Broadway play that was starring Emma Thompson, yes.
Yes, and he's also won a Tony for Spamalot.
I wonder, has he ever won a Grammy, do you know?
I don't know. We've got to call him and get him to record an album.
Find out. Let's get him on the line.
He could be one of those rare people who have, won a Tony, an Emmy, a Grammy, and an Oscar. And it's even more impressive when you do it for different projects, because sometimes you can be Cheetah Rivera and you get an Oscar for West Side Story and a Tony for West Side Story and a Grammy for West Side Story. But
yeah, that's just West Side Story.
Mike Nichols also did Elaine and May. He with Elaine May were a great, great, important comedy duo. So he started out in nightclubs doing comedy acts that were groundbreaking. And so he's really had a hell of a career,
Well,
theater, comedy, good Lord.
Think about it. He's been directing films since 1966 when he did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
A great, great movie. Very funny. He has won a Grammy Award for Best Comedy Album. So he's won Grammys, Tonys, Kennedy Center Honor, Academy Award, Drama Desk, Emmys. He's won everything.
Well, which sort of begs the question, why are they finally giving it to him now? Shouldn't he have gotten it a while ago?
Well, it's a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, hopefully when he shows up to pick up the award, he won't be arrested like Roman Polanski was when he showed up to pick up an achievement award in Switzerland a couple of weeks ago, as we've discussed now on the last two podcasts. Just this morning, Reuters is reporting that his lawyer has spoken with two different newspapers in Switzerland. One is called Sonntag. He says here, "I found him to be tired and depressed."
Aww.
Yeah, see? So his lawyer went to visit him in a Zurich prison, and he found Roman Polanski, the filmmaker, arrested after 30 years for the 1977 rape conviction of a 13-year-old girl. He says the filmmaker is tired and depressed. Yeah, I'd say so.
I can't believe they won't put him out on bail.
Well, the Swiss courts have indeed denied him bail. And Reuters reports Swiss officials have said they believe there is a very high risk of Polanski's fleeing if he is released on bail.
Yeah, you think?
From the no-brainer category of, he's been on the lam for 30 years. You think he might skip out of town?
By the way, it was not. He was not found guilty of. He was not convicted of rape. He entered a guilty plea to the charge of unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor. It's a different thing.
You know, I was really hoping that nobody
actually.
Would catch
it's
me
not
on that.
A different thing. It's it just is. Called something. It's just called something different.
No. I mean, there's different types of. You know, it's like
legally
manslaughter.
Legally, it is a different thing.
All right.
In reality,
well,
it is
morally,
not.
Ethically, it is too.
All right.
I think it's worse. But anyway.
Well, we could go on and on and on about Roman Polanski. But instead, we should let his lawyer do it. He says, Polanski was in an unsettled state of mind. As in, like, where did I leave my toothpaste?
Oh, no, this is awful.
Roman Polanski, who was 76, seemed very dejected when I visited him. I love the fact that he throws in his age. Roman Polanski, who is 76. He also said that Polanski realizes that not all of the support he has received from the outside, mostly Hollywood types, has been helpful to his cause.
No, I think it's interesting that he thinks that.
He's not in a complete bubble, then, if he's able to understand that very obvious fact.
I'm sure we'll continue to talk about it. Moving on to television, where ABC has decided to break this our suspense over who will win the hiatus or back nine contest here on Showbiz Sandbox, and told us that Flash Forward will indeed be picked up for the back nine.
Woohoo! We called that!
That's right. You both called it.
Yes.
The 8 p.m. Thursday show edged out CBS's reality stalwart Survivor in its time slot. It is the top 18 to 34-year-old new drama of the season.
That means NCIS Los Angeles is only appealing to old people because that's the top new rated show of the season. I can't get through a second episode. I watched the first episode, I started the second, and I started the third, and I just gave up. I'm just not interested.
I feel the same way.
It's good. I like it.
Wow,
I loved the first one, and by the second one, I was bored, and by the third one, I was bored, but I'm writing a piece on this, so I have to continue watching it.
And you can find that piece on industrynexus.com.
No, actually, it's on dialogues.com.
Oh.
thanks, though.
Well, the flash forward pickup was along with some other news, like ABC picking up the sitcoms The Middle, Modern Family, and Cougar Town. And what astonished me, though, was the fact that NBC dropped Southland, a cop show starring Benjamin McKenzie from The OC, before it began its second season. People are calling this the first casualty of the Jay Leno show because there's so many fewer time slots now that Tempe Alma is taken up by the underperforming Jay Leno show that there are fewer spaces to go around. But I'm really astonished because the show had a pretty good launch last season. It debuted in the ER slot, and I liked it. I was looking forward to it. It's a good cast and an interesting, promising show, and they just dumped it.
They just said, Ben never McKenzie, mind. He's so dull.
Well, he was in a hit show for 4 years or 5 years. Thank you very much. But it also stars Regina King and Tom Everett Scott and, you know, a lot of good actors. It's an ensemble series. And it was very good. It started off with good ratings. It got like 9 to 10 million viewers. But the funny thing about Flash Forward is it said, oh, my gosh, we pick up 1 million to 2 million viewers when we included our DVR numbers. And CBS had the same thing. They had an email this week saying, across the board, our shows gain more than 1 million viewers when you add in our DVR plus 7 numbers, meaning all the people who watch the show the next day or by the next week. That adds another 1 million viewers to their show, and my reaction is that all? Because I don't watch anything live. I don't know anybody who does, practically. Everybody I know watches. They're only adding 1 million people, and that doesn't seem possible. They must be undercounting.
Well, actually, when you take into consideration that DVRs are only in 30% of U.S. households, that's actually somewhat telling. But
in those 30% of households, they're used nonstop, as far as I can tell.
Well, that's true.
But, you know, I cajoled my family members into it. The second they get it, they're addicted. Forget it. They're watching Jon Stewart the next day. They don't watch things live anymore. It's a constant and immediate switchover. And I'm just astonished that in 30% of the households, they're only gaining 1 million viewers. It doesn't make any sense to me.
But a lot of the CW shows pick up a hell of a lot more in live plus 7 than any of the other networks.
They still, percentage-wise, but they're still only claiming 1 to 2 million people. Which again astonishes me because I don't think any girl watches Gossip Girl. You know, they all
yeah, we don't watch it live,
or they watch it online or whatever. You know, maybe they're watching online. I don't know. Oh well, but there's old people still count. The nice thing is that old people still count. They still watch TV
and
shows.
Tidal.
They sit there, and old people still buy CDs. They go into a store and they actually buy albums, which is why the number one album of the week is Barbra Streisand with her new album, Love is the Answer, produced by the great jazz pianist and singer Diana Krall. It sold 180,000 copies its first week, which is really, really not that much. But in this day and age, it is, I guess. And so now Streisand is tied for the Beatles for third place behind Frank Sinatra and the Rolling Stones for the
top 10 album first week sales.
Top 10 album first week sales. I don't know what that means. I thought she was tied for number one albums.
No.
That seems like a really low number, by the way.
180,000 is not even close to a top 10 album sale, because there were 10 years where wouldn't get you in the top 10.
No. It's the top.
Oh, I see. Debuts in the top 10.
Yes.
I get it. So we're saying we don't have her number, but we know that she's tied for third behind the Rolling Stones, who have 36 top 10 albums, and Frank Sinatra, who has 41. I would think Elvis would have a lot of top 10 albums too, but maybe he was before LPs. But that's very exciting news for her, because she beat out, who did she beat out? Mariah Carey?
Yes.
Yes. And and Mariah Carey's album got really good reviews too.
Great reviews.
I bet she has once a single or two kicks in, she will have much longer legs, because, you know, she'll get radio play where Barbra Streisand will not. So Barbara will have to, after a week or two, she's going to have to turn to eBay to make some money. Well, not actually eBay, but the auction house. Because what is this story about, Sperling?
Wow, he's on fire. Look at him go.
I'm like, do I need to talk?
I know. He's like banging off these stories one by one. Bab stuff up for sale. Basically, she's holding an auction. Or she's auctioning off all of 18,500 items from the life of her legendary career.
What are you going to buy?
I think most people are going to be interested in the art, the costumes, the personal clothing that she has. Like, she has all these gowns from her tour in 1994 and 2000. And she also has some costumes, the pink robe she wore in the film The Way We Were, an ensemble from Meet the Fockers. The whole point of her ensemble in that movie was that nobody would want to wear it.
I'm gonna purchase the ferry boat that she rode in the finale of Funny Girl across the New York Harbor, and then I can reenact that scene whenever I want.
I want anything that has Robert Redford in it from The Way We Were.
Well, I'm sure you'll have to break out your wallet. I'm sure it's going to cost a pretty penny.
Is she donating the proceeds to charity, or is it just for her, or what's the deal? Is it just an auction?
I did not get that far.
Oh, well. Well, she, you know, it's nice that she's doing it while she's alive rather than letting other people pick over her remains after she's gone. Because we've got a new Michael Jackson single out, which is sort of a rehash of a single that was recorded by another artist. And it shares a melody and stuff with others, blah, blah, blah. The song is called This Is It. It was released overnight digitally. I've listened to it. It sounds very lame. It's not a very good single at all. Have either of you listened to it?
No.
No.
Well, it's available online for free. You can find it at michaeljackson.com, or almost any newspaper will have at least a 30-second clip. But this, I think a lot of people, the New York Times critics who reviewed it, said they think they chose this song because it's called This Is It. And that's the title of the documentary film that shows rehearsal footage. That's the whole promo campaign for this movie. And they think they chose it just because it has the right title, not because it's the best single in his vault, because he has to have better music than this in his vault, because he would spend, you know, years in the studio. So there must be better stuff out there.
Well, we'll still need to wait another 2 weeks to decide whether the Michael Jackson rehearsal documentary is a big deal or big whoop, which is my segue into our new segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop. Let's review some of the top news stories or entertainment news stories for this week and decide whether they're a big deal or nobody gives... Well, I almost used a bad word there. All right, early reviews of Where the Wild Things Are arrive. Is it a masterpiece? Early reviews have been somewhat mixed, with some people calling it a masterpiece, an unequivocal masterpiece. However, Rotten Tomato has it at 78%. The New Yorker has given it a negative review. The Hollywood Reporter has given it a negative review. New York has given it a positive review, and Variety was positive to mixed. Is it a big deal that reviews are coming out 4 days early and they're somewhat mixed?
No.
It's a big deal, because I was hoping this would be a really good film. It won't hurt the film's commercial prospects, but Variety, I would say, was pretty negative, as well as Hollywood Reporter. Those were the two I read. So I'm definitely lowering my expectations.
Weren't your expectations pretty damn low to begin with?
No, Spike Jonze is interesting. He's an interesting filmmaker. It's a great book, and I think they just made a movie too long. It's 102 minutes. It should probably be about 75.
But didn't this movie's gotten pretty negative buzz since the very beginning?
Oh, I saw the trailer and I got really excited. I
Oh
thought it
my
was a
God, I
great
saw the
use.
trailer and I was just bored in the trailer. Maybe it's a
Okay.
girl thing.
Maybe you don't like Arcade Fire. That was the music in it. Maybe I like them too much.
I like
On to
Arcade
the
Fire, okay.
on to the next one. Did Vogue
Okay.
overly Photoshop Nicole Kidman, Penelope Cruz, Marion Cotillard, and Kate Hudson in their cover photograph for the November issue of Vogue?
I think the topic is a big deal, but I think the fact that they are reporting this is big whoop.
Big whoop.
Yes, the cast of nine on the cover of the November issue of Vogue. Now, here's one that comes from last week's show. Jimmy Kimmel pulls a Letterman. Apparently, the ABC late night leader has taken a page from David Letterman's book, granted a much more transparent and much less controversial page, with the revelation that he's been dating a longtime underling on his staff, and that comes from E! Online. Big deal or big whoop?
I feel sorry for Sarah Silverman, but big whoop.
I say big whoop, but I'm surprised you say that, Karen, since you made a good argument that dating anybody on your staff is sort of de facto sexual harassment because he's the boss. And she's hardly an underling, she's his co-head writer.
Yeah, exactly. There's that. I think my problem with Letterman was that he made it a habit of dating a lot of women on his staff.
Well, we know of two, don't we?
No, if two or three have come forward, nobody else has come forward. But you get the typical anonymous sources and stuff who say that he makes sort of a habit of dating and flirting and sleeping with various women. I mean, okay, anonymous sources, I know, but I'm of the I have the belief that where there's smoke, there's fire. And if these anonymous sources are all saying this, I have to believe there is some truth to there somewhere. Now, do I
Are they?
approve of Kimmel dating a staffer? Not really, but this is like a one. This is one staffer. If he starts making a habit of it, then I'm like, okay, come on.
All right, moving on. Adrien Brody takes on the Predator remake, the remake of the film Predator, which Arnold Schwarzenegger, or I should say Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, originally starred in. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
I say it's a big whoop that he took the role, but it's a big deal that the fans reacted so negatively. I've never been a fan of Adrien Brody. I think he's an utterly uninteresting actor, and
I
I
think he's
can't.
lucky to be working. I
Oh yeah, and so Predator's an unimportant franchise, but even the fans of Predator were like, "No, not Adrien Brody. He sucks." So it's great. I'm sure they were all over Jeff Boucher's blog, Hero Complex, talking about it.
Well, somebody else people love to hate is Lindsay Lohan, and nobody seemed to like her fashion line, which was unveiled in Paris this past week. I guess she is the, I guess,
Artistic advisor.
Artistic advisor, French fashion house, Emmanuel Ungaro. And she brought her designs out onto the runway, and they were immediately panned.
I think this is sort of a big deal, actually. I think it's a big deal both for her and her career and for fashion.
Well, but her career doesn't depend on it in the least, so what does it matter?
Well, because it was so panned that she's really kind of her career's in a position right now where she needs to have a hit almost no matter what it is. And that for her to have gone off in this direction and done something really kind of stupid and have that be panned as well, she's even more of a joke. You know that her representatives right now are going, "Oh God."
Okay, moving on to Miley Cyrus, who is not moving on to Twitter because she quit Twitter.
Oh, boo-hoo. Big whoop.
Because her boyfriend Liam Hemsworth presumably asked her to, and he's a good-looking guy.
Wait, he did? Oh, this is a
Well,
little bit more of
that's
a
the
leak then.
rumor. That's the rumor. He
That's
said
just.
you got to get off Twitter, he said.
Well, he's probably right, but I don't know. I don't like the idea of any girl doing what her boyfriend tells her to do.
Well, Karen, then you're going to be very happy because Miley Cyrus says herself that it was not her boyfriend that got her to quit Twitter. In fact, she's got a little YouTube rap video that she's recorded. And I'm going to see if I can play it here. She's sitting here bouncing up and down with her friends like a
Yeah,
rap
the
star.
rumors are true. I deleted my Twitter. Huh? Can you believe it? I got 2 million. Then I say adios. I had to say goodbye. And this little rap is to tell my fans why.
Oh no! No!
Friend told me to. Y'all know very well what you say. I
releases a rap single every week telling what she's up to.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Put it on our Twitter.
I thought you guys would get a kick out of that. So are we saying it's a big deal or a big whoop? I guess I'm getting big whoop out of this.
It's a big whoop. Yeah, we could care less.
It's a big whoop, but it doesn't make it any less awesome.
I would do anything Liam Hemsworth told me to if I was dating him, but that's just me. Anyway,
I don't know who that is.
I don't know either.
He plays her love interest in her next movie, The Last Song, or whatever it's called.
Oh, okay. Well, if you think he's cute, then I will too, so I'll fight you for him.
The last item. This one is almost not an item because we all knew it was going to happen. Tom DeLay exits Dancing with the Stars. He was either going to get voted off the show or quit, one or the other. He is, of course, the politician, the former, is it House Majority Leader? Or was he the Senate Majority? I don't know. The hammer in the U.S. Congress. And he announced that he's done with Dancing with the Stars due to a stress fracture in both feet.
Okay.
Karen, big deal or big whoop?
Yay. Big whoop.
Oh, no, it's a big deal because television is safe for family viewing again. Any possibility you could see video of him. And it wasn't just on Dancing with the Stars. Late at night, suddenly it's on Extra. It's on everybody's showing him dancing, and it was just horrifying. And I'm glad that won't ever happen again.
Are you watching it? I guess you are. You're watching it this
No, I wasn't watching Dancing with the Stars, but on Extra and other channels that would be on late at night when I turn on the TV, there he was. Everybody, talk shows, everybody wanted to show video of Tom DeLay doing the bump and grind, and it was very upsetting. It was not safe for children.
Ooh, bump and grind and Tom DeLay. I don't want to.
Literally.
Well, normally this would be the time where we go into our inside baseball segment with, as I mentioned earlier, Ann Thompson and James Rocky. However, we are going to be posting that interview later in the week because it's an engaging and interesting interview. And I think that rather than try and edit it down to a manageable size, we should probably just leave it whole and some important things were said, and we should just post it as a special episode. What do you think?
Absolutely. Hot off the presses.
Yeah. I mean,
I would say, you know, they can look for that on, say, Thursday or Friday. You know, like give them a few days to have to this week's and then a special edition of Showbiz for the weekend.
That's right. We're thinking of you all the time. Podcast for your week, podcast for your weekend. So, yes, look for it on Friday or Thursday or whenever I can post it. For this episode, you can find the show notes on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of our social networking sites. Of course, all the usual suspects are there, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. If you would like to email us any comments about what we've discussed on the show or feedback on the show, dirt@showbizsandbox is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also send us a voicemail, or I guess you wouldn't send a voicemail. You would call us and leave a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. The number again is 888-567-7263. And you can find Karen on industrynexus.com, right?
That's correct.
And on Twitter, kwoody3939. Michael Giltz is at michaelgiltz.com and at Michael Giltz on Twitter. I'm on Celluloid Junkie and at Sperling on Twitter. Until next week, or until Friday, play nice.